Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Oh yeah, welcome to that bonus episode of the Permaculture Pimpcast, the only pimpcast on planet Earth where we discuss permaculture, preparedness, and practical living. Look, we got a great interview for y'all today. You're going to be glad you tuned in, and you're going to get a lot of awesome resources. But, got to tell you right off, this episode brought to you by Hickory Ridge Soap from twooldcrowshomestead.com. Turn that simp into a pimp. Bam! Also, Heaven's Harvest, y'all, 10% off with promo code PERMA. EMP Shield, y'all, $50 off with promo code PERMA once again. Remember, as a former journeyman, well, I'm still a journeyman electrician, but remember, your number one threat out there is not necessarily an EMP. It is lightning strikes. And they have a guarantee, an ironclad guarantee that nobody can keep up with. So definitely check out the people over at EMP Shield. You'll be glad you did. All right, so I did all that up front, y'all, for the express purpose to get right into it with a friend of mine. And he's also something of a podcaster. He wears quite a few hats out there. You're going to want to take down the resource, y'all. You're going to want to know who he is, and you're going to want to keep up with the information that he provides. Now, a while back, a number of people were asking, well, where do you get your information? Where do you find it? How do you glean it? How do you know from all these I'll just call them fear-mongers out there, or the profligate prostitutes, whatever you want to call them. Everybody's wondering, where do I get my information? How do you distill it down? Who do you know to go to? Well, we're talking to one of them today who, honestly, y'all, you're going to be glad you listened. You're going to want to check him out. With that said, man in America himself, Seth Holehouse. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, I'm so good, man. It's so great to finally be on your show. I've been waiting for quite some time for this. I know I've been really busy and you've been busy, but it's wonderful to be here with you.
Well, it's great to have you on here. I was on your show not too long, a while back. And like you said, we've been trying to touch bases for a while now, but both of us are up to our eyeballs in so many different things. And hopefully we get into some of that today. But why don't you tell a little bit about yourself? And every hero, every superhero, which you are one, of course, folks, he's too modest to ever tell you that. But yeah, he's a superhero in his own way. And I'll tell you about that here a little bit later. But why don't you tell us your origin story and what brought you to this work, Seth?
Yeah, so I'll try to make it somewhat concise. I grew up in small town Ohio, a little town actually literally called Plain City. It was just flat farmland. And, you know, just, you know, grew up as a lot of our, you know, probably your listeners did, you know, running outside, swimming in the creek, catching, you know, crawdads and you know, tadpoles and little smallmouth bass. And anyway, so ended up going to art school. So I was much more of my passion was the creative aspect of things. And I went to a liberal arts school. This is back in the early 2000s. And something happened in that school that changed the course of my life. And so I went into school thinking, okay, because I studied industrial design, right? Designing products like a toaster or a laptop. That was, you know, it was really kind of it was a blend of art and engineering. And so I liked the end marketing. So I liked all those things together. And even though it was actually a very liberal art school, and I'm talking even back at that time, early 2000s, you know, I had, you know, teachers that were showing us like very, very pro, like, you know, almost like sexual gay scene movies in some of our liberal writing classes. Like it was already being pushed into college at that time. I didn't really know what to make of it. But what happened, is I had met, through some mutual friends, I met this Chinese guy, really interesting guy. And he was on a full ride scholarship to OSU, big college here, in Ohio. And nice guy, but he had this softness to him and this quietness. Like there was something about his past. I got talking to him one day and I said, tell me a little more about your past. And I came to find out that he had spent about 8 years in a labor camp in mainland China. And it wasn't like, we think of, in a prison working, stamping, license plates or, those kinds of things. And that wasn't what it is. He was working about 18 hours a day. If he refused to work, he was tortured. He was strapped up to a bed, hit, shocked with a cattle prod. He was starved, force-fed, beaten, everything you can imagine, sodomized. I mean, it was absolutely horrific. Now, what's crazy is one of the things that he was doing in there, you know how we get the pistachio nuts and they're already cracked?
Right.
And they might say organic, grown in California. Well, what happens, you have these American companies that are growing these nuts in America, shipping them to China. They're being cracked in China and sent back to us for our consumption. And so one of his jobs of many that he was forced to do, obviously wasn't being paid, was actually cracking these pistachio nuts. And he told me that in the corner of the room where he was forced to work, they actually had a wooden bucket, which is where they would urinate and defecate. And if the nuts were too hard to crack, they'd toss them in the bucket to soak for a little bit, then pull them out to crack them. So this something about meeting, it shattered my reality to meet this young man. And the reason he had gone through this, it wasn't because he was caught dealing heroin or, he was attempted murder. For him, it was actually because of his faith. So he had done this meditation practice called Falun Gong, which was really popular in China in the 90s, got extremely popular until in 99, they banned it. And anyone who's caught basically meditating in the park was treated as an enemy of the state and thrown into a prison like that. And so, growing up in the way that I did in Ohio, it was it was really quite a bubble. I didn't see evil. And I think that's something that's really important because maybe we can talk about Sound of Freedom a little bit at some point. We recently watched Sound of Freedom. And I think that it's really, really important for good people to see evil because we have to know what's there. And when we live a very comfortable, cushy life, a lot of times we don't think that evil exists in the world and it makes us blind to it. And it makes us actually very susceptible to going along with it, which is very dangerous. And so something about this interaction for me, I saw evil through this person. And what that did is I think that when we see evil, we can do really, there's really your three reactions, right? It's fight, flight, or freeze. Some people, they see it, they kind of freeze up and they say, okay, I'm not sure, I can't really deal with it. Some people, they run away from it. I don't want to talk about it. But some people, they say, I'm going to fight the evil, right? And that's what came out in me. So, it was God looking over me that at that time, as a young college student, something awoke inside of me and it became my life mission to fight against communism. And this was before I knew anything about the communist subversion here in America. This was something that I just felt like I have to do whatever possible to raise awareness about what's happening around the world in these communist countries. And so that, we're kind of getting into the end of the origin story. So that was the real origin. Fast forward. So I graduated from college. I went and I found a job as media company, Epoch Times. I know you're familiar with them.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2008, it was really early on for them, but I was so attracted to their mission of fighting against communism and exposing and bringing people to the truth that I just threw myself into that for nearly a decade. Fast forward a little more. It's, I was living in New York City for that. So I moved to New York after college to do that. 2020 rolls around. Right as we're entering in 2020, we find out my wife is pregnant. We say, okay, you know what? It's time to leave the city. Let's go back to Ohio. So we come back to Ohio and, early 2020, we're, watching what's happening with the election. We think, there's a red wave. You're seeing Trump flags everywhere. we're feeling really confident going into the election. Now I know we're on YouTube, so I won't get too into detail with it, but we all know what happened that
night.
You
go as far as you want, brother. Hey, if I get kicked off, I get kicked off. We're not censoring anything.
Okay. Yep. So we know what happened November 3rd. And anyway, so after that, you know, my wife and I, the next couple of days, we're like, well, how do we fight this? Because we saw this as a coup. We saw this as a communist coup in our country to remove the rightful leader that we chose and put in somebody that was really, as we're seeing now, completely controlled by communist and globalist interests, whether through bribery or blackmail or any number of that stuff. And so we said, well, how can we fight? And so we'd been following General Flynn and a lot of those, you know, great heroes like that that were on the front lines. And General Flynn specifically talking a lot about how this is an information war. It's 5GW, it's fifth generation warfare. In the Chinese textbook, it's unrestricted warfare. And so, well, we're not going to go grab a musket or a pitchfork like our founding fathers did. We're going to fight with information. And so within a couple of days of the election, we decided like, okay, well, you know what? Let's just make a YouTube channel. Let's just make a YouTube channel. Let's make a video. Let's show people what happened, you know, 2020, show people what happened with, you know, COVID and how that was used to change all the mail-in voting laws and everything. Talk to people about BLM, the communist insurrection in America, and really expose the bigger picture, the media, looking back into history, the collapsing, the destruction of our statues and the Cultural Revolution happening in America. So we spent about 3 to 4 weeks making this video called The Plot to Steal America. We put it up online. It started really going kind of viral on Facebook because at this point we weren't shadow banned because we were a brand new account, right? They had no idea who we were. We were just some new account on YouTube and Facebook. And after a couple of weeks, I think it was just after Christmas, this is in 2020, woke up one morning and I had a dream. Funny, I had a dream the night before that video got I opened it up and it said 40 million views. Wow. Right. So the next morning I woke up and I was like, oh, that was a cool dream. You know, a couple hours later, all of a sudden I get all these text messages and phone calls coming in instantly. I pick up and one of my buddies, I said, what happened? He goes, dude, you'll never guess who just shared your video. And I said, I don't know, you know, General Flynn. He goes, no, President Trump. And so, you know, this is back when President Trump was still on social media. So he took that video, he tweeted it multiple times. He pinned it on the top of his Twitter profile. This is with 90 million followers. They uploaded the video directly to all of his platforms. So if you went to YouTube, Trump's official, you know, YouTube, White House YouTube, that was the video that was playing. Trump's Facebook page, that was the video was playing. And so it probably got, we think that it probably got close to a couple hundred million views across all the different, you know, kind of platforms. And so we didn't set out to do this. That wasn't our intention. It was my wife and I, you know, she was, you know, behind the scenes, really helping, supporting, writing, editing, just doing amazing stuff, setting up our technology, which you've seen here in the studio. And but it was just, that was where God wanted us, you know, and that was the thing, is that as we're kind of at that discussion point of what do we do, it was really a step back into saying, well, God, what do you want us to do? This is a battle of good and evil. Where do you want us? Do you want us on the front line? Do you want us as a medic? Do you want us as a general? Do you want us as a sniper, as a, you know, infantry, whatever it is, put us where you want us. And that was how we ended up doing this. And that's what has led to me now doing this. You know, this is our full-time thing. It's all we do aside from, you know, kind of being busy with a homestead and a family and all that stuff. But this is now what we do. And I think that it's exactly what you're doing. We are, you know, we are fighting on the front lines of an information war. It's not that we're not YouTubers. We're actually soldiers at war. It's just that this is a different generation of warfare.
Seth, I mean, there's a number of places I could go in here. Folks, I'll just say that right from the get-go, when Seth told me the story about the Chinese guy and him throwing the pistachios in the bucket, I stopped eating pistachios, I kid you not, not because of that story. Not at all because of that part of the story. The fact that I now was confronted with the idea that, okay, if this guy was over there cracking these pistachios, surely a whole host of others, armies probably, are over there doing the same exact thing. And I love pistachios. Love pistachio pudding, pistachio ice cream, pistachio this and that. But ever since, I remember sitting at that restaurant when we came up to visit you, in Ohio, and that was the first time you told me that story. I haven't eaten a pistachio ever since. And that is, to me, another way of fighting this thing. And it's insidious. It's nasty. But now I had, thanks to you, an up-close personal look as to where, as a farmer, I like to know where everything comes in the chain. And now all of a sudden, how do I possibly eat a pistachio? I'm sure maybe there are some out there that are harvested differently. But if they are, they almost certainly aren't coming, you know, without a husk on them. So you'd probably have to get them whole to get them any other way. But that, just that small thing of knowing where those pistachios come from was honestly, I thought I was out of the matrix in so many different ways, but here I am. Here's another little piece in where I'm still chained to the bottom of Plato's cave because I didn't know any better until you told me. And then when you overlay this with all the other things, Smithfield Farms, all that plastic, that pork under plastic, guess what? It gets put on a boat, sent over to China. Do you even want to start thinking about what's happening over there before they repackage it just to turn it on a boat and send it back to us? And then here we are eating it under plastic. What they're doing, only God knows. I want to kind of shift on into something because this is one of the many areas, folks, where Seth is extraordinary. He and his wife. And I've had the great pleasure of meeting them both. I know in this short format, we're not going to be able to cover everything, but there's one area where you are extremely, well, one of many areas where you and your wife are extremely unique. And that is in the area where, I don't know how to say this without offending some people, but I'm just going to say it because I don't know any other way to say it. My experience is most of the people in the left side of the equation, they'll grow their kale, their broccoli, and stuff like that. They grow it and they eat it. Most people on the MAGA side of the equation, they don't grow anything at all. They typically get storable food, stick it away, and then if a rainy day rolls around, you know, that's when they pull it out. You are that extraordinarily rare person, especially in the media, who has basically overlaid one with the other. So why don't you walk us through that part of the journey where, and now, folks, don't get me wrong, storable food has its place. But do you have any idea how many battles in history were lost because of logistics? Where do you think everybody, most people have heard of the term a Pyrrhic victory. What most people don't realize is that Pyrrhus was a Greek general that was kicking the crap out of the Romans. The Romans, the only way they were able to defeat Pyrrhus is because they had a better supply network. No matter how many people Pyrrhus killed, you know, he won the battles, but he lost the war. That's basically where the term Pyrrhic victory came from. And it all came down to resupply. So, Seth, I know that was a long, drawn-out way of getting into it, but I want to know, first of all, I don't even know if you can answer this part, but you're one of maybe five people I know in the MAGA movement that understand this value of overlaying the storable food with your ability to reproduce it. Why don't you take us on that journey?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because it is a journey is the best way to describe that, pardon me, that process because, you know, when, gosh, you know, 4 years ago, you know, my wife and I were living in a high-rise apartment in Manhattan. I mean, you know, talk about being the opposite side of the spectrum. We didn't even have a balcony we could grow something on. If I wanted to grow some food, I would have to hopefully, you know, shove something in the window and just hope that the sun would have hit it from the right angle to give us some food. So that's where we came from. And so I think that there's a handful of things on this journey. And I think that for us, a lot of the journey started in a place of fear. You know, it started in the place of thinking, okay, there's food shortages coming, supply chains collapsing. You know, there's going to be, you know, basically a zombie apocalypse, right? As Mike Adams has eloquently described many times, right? And so, so that initial place was fear. And so it was, you know, us just going to, you know, a lot of times Azure Market, Azure Standard, just doing these big bulk orders. You know, we didn't go straight to the storable food buckets because we were thinking, well, you could buy that, but I can buy, you know, 50 pounds of, you know, dried organic black beans, throw them in a 5-gallon bucket with an oxygen packet. They're going to last for 25 years. and that's going to be a tenth of the cost as a, you know, one of the buckets. The buckets are still good. I mean, I've got a bunch of Heaven's Harvest stuff, which is I do recommend to people because it's rounded out and it's also easy. You press a button, it shows up. Whereas we've put a lot of work into preparing, but that initial thought was it was very fear-based. It was looking, and it was a very selfish perspective. So I think that fear really is rooted in selfishness, right? Because fear is what's going to happen to me, okay? And when you can uproot that selfishness and think, what's going to happen to my neighbor? What's going to happen to my family? What's going to happen to my child? It starts to change your perspective. And so we went through this journey of, you know, the first, say, year and a half or so of kind of entering into COVID, really in a lot of ways just packing away like squirrels, preparing for the apocalypse. And something shifted in us, though, and this is the important part, because it's not just about buy some storable food or get some seeds, learn how to garden so you can eat what you can grow. For us, it was much deeper. And we can talk about that depth in a little bit here, because I think it's important to talk about depth and purpose and helping to understand like what's, especially for us, like what's driven us to do things and what's driven us to make very big changes, which one big change we're making right now in our lives we can talk about. But the depth for us came from this perspective of we don't want to live in fear. We want to live in abundance. We want to live in a way that every day we're waking up and we're looking forward to doing what we're doing. We're not just scrambling to try to survive. And it was interesting because, you know, one of the things I've really spent, you know, quite some time trying to understand and study is the whole idea of the Great Reset, transhumanism, how it ties into the communist agenda, the globalist agenda. And if you distill that whole system down, what you find is that entire agenda is really predicated upon a simple principle: make humans as little human as possible.
Bam.
And that's what it comes down to. Make us as machine as possible, because they can control the machines. They can't control God's creation. They can control everything. They can control the social media, the algorithms, the smart meters, the chemtrails. They can control all those things. And if we pull ourselves so much into that system, they will control us. And so that became the solution. It wasn't about fighting to win in this battle of the Great Reset. It was actually about just being human again and getting back to being human. And we said, gosh, you know what? Like, we're gonna start really taking control of all the different inputs that we need to things that 100 years ago, my great grandparents, they were all farmers and they were preservers. They had root cellars. They knew how to fish. They knew how to, you know, catch a rabbit. They knew how to do all of these different things that we no longer know, because I really think that there's a way that God set things up for us to live. There's a way of life that I think a way of living that's in line with what I believe is the divine way that humans can align. And so when we go further away from that, it's like we go deeper into Plato's cave, we go deeper into the delusion, deeper into the matrix. And so we shifted that mentality, and it was about, you know, going back towards tradition again. And so then it kind of shifted. It's like, okay, well, what are we going to do? It's like, well, you know what? Let's, instead of using paper towels and paper napkins, let's get cloth paper towels and cloth napkins, right? Let's get some new, you know, kind of clothing racks. We're going to dry all of our clothes after we wash them. We're going to plant our food. We're going to really kind of dig into the soil. We're going to raise our chickens. We're going to live off the land, because all those things, it wasn't about survival anymore. It was about, this is the way that God gave us. You know, you plant, like, as you know perfectly well, better than most, you take a seed, you plant that seed in God's earth with the sun and the rain. That seed, through the plants, it grows, and their seeds and their seeds, you can feed a village in a couple of years off of that single seed. There's nothing that mankind has come close to creating that can accomplish that. As marvelous as they say that modern technology is, nothing comes close to that. And that was, so that was, it turned it into this beautiful process of just going back. And so instead of being fearful and prepping, it was this, it became this journey of understanding and remembering. That's all. I think it's a lot of these things are really deep inside of us and they've been covered up. So it's not like I don't believe that we come in as a blank canvas and we know nothing. Like, I believe that we have souls, and I think that our souls are probably very, very old, and they have a lot of wisdom. There's a lot of depth to that knowledge of our soul. And that's also, you know, we've got our intuition that comes from God. And so I think that it was this process of not just, okay, how can we read all these different books and all that, but it was actually going back to trying to remember. And as you're working with soil, as you're, you know, working with your animals, your livestock, this intuition comes back. You start smelling things again, your senses heighten. And so anyway, that's kind of a long kind of roundabout of, you know, kind of what changed about us, is that it's not about prepping and buying storable food. It's about living in a way that is as maximally as human as possible. And actually how that in and of itself brings you closer to God, and it makes you so much more resilient to the globalist communist Great Reset agenda.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Folks, if he's being modest, he and his wife have done more. Now, they have a schedule that would knock your socks off. Of all the consultations I've ever done, William has done even far more than I have. There was a little bit of concern, I think, with his wife, with Seth's wife. When we got there, we were like, this is like in the top 1% of anything we've ever seen before on an initial consultation. So you guys were really tough on yourself, and particularly Kate. And I was astonished at how much you had done, and it was light years better than either one of you had thought. Now, walk us through that part of it, because there's a lot of people, the record, according to Joel Salatin, one of the fastest growing segments in this country right now are the people that are going back to the land. And if you could only see my inbox right now, there's tons of questions that I will almost certainly have to answer, that I enjoy answering actually in the podcast. And people, in light of what they're saying, they're listening to a Mike Adams podcast, and I love Mike Adams. And they're like, oh, heavens to Murgatroyd, what am I going to do? And, you know, and he puts out some really good information there. I want to qualify that, but they're wondering where to start. So I'm going to give them a different set of information than I have been for some time. But how did you and Kate start? I mean, like you said, you came from New York City in a high rise to here you are in Ohio, and then you moved to another place in Ohio to where you currently are right now. How did you get over that learning curve and figuring out where to start? And I'm asking this, folks, because they did it right. They're going to be tough on themselves, but they actually did a lot of it. If I was advising them, I don't know that I would have changed up a whole lot. But Seth, where did y'all start?
Well, so thankfully, my wife, she grew up, you know, so she's from Australia. She grew up on a more of a homestead there. So they had chickens and they had some livestock and everything. So she had that already. And thankfully, she had also studied permaculture. So she was very familiar with a lot of the core fundamentals of, you know, whether it's soil health or zones or any of the core things that you're talking a lot about. And so that became a good foundation. But a lot of it, I mean, that doesn't mean that you can go and plant a garden in year one, it's going to go perfectly. I think that something that just for both of us, how we are really the kind of people that we build the airplane as it's kind of taken off. And that's just how we've always been. It's the momentum of getting started. It's like you'll never get to a place where you're thinking, you know what, I know everything now and I'm finally ready to start. And we've both just experienced that it's the doing, it's the making the mistakes, not being afraid of making mistakes, not being afraid of, you know, of waste, of screwing something up. I mean, I probably wasted, gosh, 500 hours of work on doing things the wrong way and having to fix it later. But that's how, you know, you learn. And so we started small. You know, we came back from Ohio. We were staying with my parents for a couple of months as we were looking for the next place. We then found a rental. It was a rental on about an acre of land, much more in suburbia. we bought the square foot gardening book, and I built three simple, you know, I think 4-foot by 8-foot raised bed gardens in the backyard of the rental property. And we did our first garden together. We learned a ton, right? And then shortly after that, we found the place that we live now, because we, you know, we've been looking and looking for a place to buy, and it was the right place. And so we just took those skills and we expanded, and we said, okay, you know what, we're going to do some fruit tree guilds, and we're going to build out a food forest. And we knew a little bit about, my wife knew more than I did, but a lot of it was actually just watching YouTube videos, watching some of your videos, reading books, buying books, just really just becoming sponges of information, you know, watching, you know, Joel Salatin's videos and his documentary, and just studying all these different ways that people were doing things and just trying to assimilate that information. But I think that for both her and I, especially her, she's very, very intelligent. We're just researchers, and we'll just, if we don't know something, not knowing something has never been a sticking point. It's just this belief, and maybe it's part of the younger generation too, because I find that some of the older generations I interact with, they're like, well, how do you do that? I'm like, I don't know, I'll figure it out, right? Maybe it's like the Google generation, right? Where we're just used to, how do you, you know, change out a toilet? How do you fix a flat tire? Well, you just figure it out if you haven't been taught it from your father or your grandfather. And so we just figured a lot of things out as we went. We followed our intuition. We tried to spend time on the land as best as we could, you know, looking at the land, feeling out the land. And just, we did a lot of the labor ourselves. I moved, gosh, probably dozens of yards of soil and sod and everything. Since then I bought a little Kubota tractor, which was life changing, but we got our hands dirty. That was it. Like that was one of the key things too, is that don't intellectualize it. Don't sit there and try to map it perfectly out on paper. Just dig in, get our hands dirty, make some mistakes, have a whole crop fail, and be like, oh gosh, so that's why the crop didn't work. It's like, okay, well, we'll fix that next time. It's really, you know, it's the one straw revolution, right? You just watch nature and listen enough, and eventually you'll start to see that nature teaches you what it needs.
I got to ask, because I know how busy you are, you and Kate both. The thing I find astonishing is how much you're able to get done. I mean, this is what I do for a living, and I have been for a long time. And even I am astonished at what you two have been able to achieve despite working hours and hours and hours and hours a day. And that's one of the biggest questions I get that I'm not always sure I know how to answer adequately, in terms of, hey, we both have two jobs. In your case, you're wearing a lot of hats. Kate's doing exactly the same thing. And then at the same time, you're parents to a very young daughter, and doing all the other things, the speaking engagements, all the other things you do. How on earth, now this is one question, Seth, that maybe you might be able to help out with, because I get it all the time. We are very, very busy people. How on earth do we manage the time to do these other things? How did you do it?
Well, I think that there's one important principle with this, is that time is one of the few things that makes us all truly equal. As much as they want to say that, you know, you can love who you want to love, you can do whatever you want to do, and we're all equal. It's like, no, that's a lot. That's, you know, part of the same communist agenda to drive us away from God. But the time, I've got 24 hours a day. You've got 24 hours a day. George Soros has 24 hours a day. Donald Trump has 24 hours a day. We're all equalized by time. And so why is it that, you know, one person can be accomplishing 5 times that of the other person? And I think that in our case, for us, it really came down, I would say it came down to purpose and priorities. Priorities are derived from purpose. And so for us, our purpose really became rooted in a few core things. One is our show. This is a big part of our purpose. We believe there's a battle of good and evil. We're fighting in the war. This is how we're doing it. So the show was something that was a very, very central to our purpose here on earth. And therefore, it became a very high priority. Now, there were times when we published less, or we only got one show out that week because we were really busy with this other task. But now we're back to the point where we're putting out about 5 shows every week now. which is enough to keep us quite busy. But that's, it's so high up on that purpose chart. And you know, also a lot of things that we've done over the years is we'll sit down and write things out. We'll, you know, whether we're trying to figure out what kind of house we want to live in, how we want our life to look like, we'll sit there and make a big list and we'll put numbers on things. It's like, okay, how do you weight this one? How do you weight this one? And for us, it's really about, you know, kind of mapping out what our priorities are. And so, so that was, you know, again, the show, major, major purpose, major, major priority. Sustainability, you know, being able to provide for my family, you know, being able to look to a future where even if I go a whole year and without being able to go to the grocery store, I'm not going to be worried about feeding my own daughter or feeding my wife or feeding my mom or my dad. Right. So that was another thing. That was a purpose. That's something very purpose driven for me, is I have to be the provider. I have to provide for my wife, my child on the way, which, you know, is some exciting kind of news that's kind of come into the mix. My parents, the people surrounding me, I need to strive to be the provider. Like that's a purpose for me. And so that was that right there. Then that took all those priorities of, you know, growing, building garden beds, working the soil, building a chicken coop, all those just started really climbing that list. And so once we looked at our week between those two main purpose-driven items, there wasn't a whole lot of other time. So it just meant that, you know, for someone that says, I don't have any time to grow a garden, I would ask, well, what kind of TV do you watch? Mm-hmm. What do you do in the evenings? You work two jobs. Well, you're not working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, I imagine, right? So, you know, you want to be with your kids. Okay, pull your kids in the garden with you. You know, maybe it means that you can't go play cards every Tuesday night. Maybe it means, you know, and so for us, it felt like it was about 2.5 years that I feel like we basically didn't take a day off. Right? 7 days a week. It's either we're putting our show together, we're editing some videos, we're digging some gardens, we're planting some plants, we're canning, we're freeze drying, we're dehydrating, we're building our property out. That was it. It's just that we worked, you know, I'm not gonna say we didn't take any breaks, because we would. A lot of evenings we'd sit down and watch, you know, watch a couple of reruns of Seinfeld just as a way to kind of tune out, right? But overall though, we didn't have this mentality of like, oh gosh, it's Saturday now. What do you want to do? Like, well, let's go to the swimming pool all day, or let's go hiking all day. It was really like, oh, okay, great. It's Saturday. We can drop our daughter off with my mom and I can go finish building out those terrace garden beds. It'll take me 8 hours. I've got the time window to do it. So I guess that's how, you know, we don't have any magic, you know, secret formula or secret sauce that gives us more time. What gives us more time is just saying no to a lot of things. And that's not easy, right? It's not easy to do that. But again, it's just when you're very clear about what your purpose is in life, and then you're very clear about what your priorities are to support that purpose, it makes it a lot easier to say no to the things that don't align with that.
Well, Seth, I wish that were helpful to all the people out there that heard me say the same exact thing, because it's, I mean, really, it's true. I mean, if you want something done, give it to a busy person. It's always been that way. And when I talk to the people that have, and it really comes down to time management and priorities and what you think is most important. You know, so folks, I mean, there, you know, that's a trifecta, because Joel Salatin said almost word for word the same exact thing. So it's really not a matter of, even when I was working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for other people, I still managed in some of my earliest YouTube videos to do a segment called Farming at Work. I was working that 12 hours and then still, minus the 8 hours I was sleeping or taking a shower, whatever the case may be, I still built an entire food forest on a construction site. So it can be done. And it can be done when you're working out in 100 plus heat 7 days a week with no breaks. Now, I don't always recommend that. And like Seth said, there are going to be those times where I sit down and maybe I watch somebody feed Phil, you know, or Seinfeld or whatever the case may be. So you can have those breaks, but it also comes down to what you're doing in your spare time. Seth,
I'll add one thing, sure. Actually, as I was thinking about it, is that, you know, as I talked about earlier, in the college years, transitioning into my early adulthood, moving to New York City, working for the media, that was like, I found my, that great purpose at that time, and everything aligned with that. My wife was the same. Like, my wife's from, she's from Australia. She had a similar process where she was, I think, 20 years old. She had her own interaction in Australia with understanding and kind of bumping into this persecution happening in China. In 2001, she literally, as a Westerner, went into Tiananmen Square in China and unfurled a banner, a human rights banner, and was arrested and put into a Chinese prison overnight until they realized that her and her friend she was with, they were all international people, and you know, they couldn't keep them locked up. So then they changed their tune real quick. But it was almost from day one, there was that purpose. And so, you know, in New York City, for instance, I went years of working 80, 90, 100-hour work weeks. I think one time we were doing a website redesign. That's actually how I met my wife. She was working alongside me in a lot of these different projects. I think that I was tracking my hours. I think that there's a month or so went by, and I was clocking 105 hours, 108 hours, 112 hours in a work week. And so because we were so driven by that purpose, and so doing that for almost 10 years, it laid this foundation. And I'm very grateful for that. It really sucked a lot in many ways, but it laid this foundation of like, if you have to turn that on and, you know, you have to work, you know, 80, 90, 100 hours to get something really important done, you figure out how to get it done. And I think that's part of it. I think that a lot of people, they feel like they don't have much time, but they've also been conditioned into the 40-hour work week.
Absolutely.
You know, conditioned into like, you know what, you work 9 to 5, your weekends are yours, your evenings are yours, and maybe there's a few evenings you can set aside for some gardening. It's just that broke. Actually, well, straight from college, I moved to New York City and went straight into working for the media. So I never built that habit of the 40-hour work week. And so I'm really grateful for that. So I just wanted to add that, because I feel like that gave us a really good foundation.
I'm glad you brought that up, because in this type of work in homestead, I almost hate the homesteading word, because it just means so many different things for so many different people, but let's just call it agriculture, or particularly permaculture agriculture, or one in which you do where you actually make a living like we do. There is no such thing as a 40-hour week, and I think you just knocked it out of the park with just pointing that out, Seth. I mean, I was conditioned, because I came up in the union as a union journeyman electrician, and we got all these different sayings, and when you hear them, they kind of put you into this bubble of partially entitlement, but also laziness. One saying we used to say was, they make a dollar, we make a dime, that's why we pee on company time. Or it's hide and seek for $5,000 a week. Or it's, you know, a bunch of different things like that that make you think, okay, it puts you in this mindset that makes you, that really doesn't set you up for success. Because I don't know about you, but I don't know if anybody's successful in anything that works 40 hours a week. First of all, I'm doing what I love, and I know to a great extent you're doing the same, and you do some, I still, at the end of the day, as a person who is busy 24/7, I still don't know how you and Kate get done what you did get done, because you're texting me pictures when I was just there a week prior. And I'm like, what? Hey, William, take a look at this. He's like, how did they do all that? I'm like, man, I don't even know. I mean, this is what we do for a living, and even I don't know. I'm guessing you got a bunch of gremlins over there hidden under the porch somewhere I didn't know about, but it is truly astonishing what you guys get done. Seth, I want to move into your day job, and I know it's really all of the above. And, folks, this is where I really, really, really want you to pay attention, because I'll give you a little background about how I discovered Seth. I was leaving the Self-Reliance Festival in Camden, Tennessee, and a couple of my friends said, hey, you got to check this dude out. And I'd never heard of him before. And they said, and it was the second time at the same event I heard somebody say, Man in America. And I'm thinking, okay, well, who is this guy? Then she sent me a video of you. Actually, she sent me like 10 videos, and I'm driving back from Camden, Tennessee, which for me is about 6 hours. And then back to back, I'm listening to your interviews, and I'm like, okay, who's this dude? All right. Listen to another one. And I'm like, okay, before I know it, you accompanied me almost all 6 hours home. kind of binge listening. No, it was the greatest thing, and it's gotten even better. So, folks, you want to check this out. And Seth, why don't you tell everybody about, because there's one interview that you did recently I want to ask you about. It's not a gotcha thing or anything like that, but honestly, it put me on my heels when I saw that you did this interview. But, well, that's one of, as of many as of late, which I'll get to that in a minute. But why don't you tell everybody about your show? I know you kind of did to a certain extent, but why don't you tell them what you're trying to do with it?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, you know, our show is called Man in America. Rumble's our main place or podcast. You know, we do everything. YouTube, maybe 15% of our content goes up to YouTube because we tend to kind of talk about the things that YouTube doesn't like. So, but, you know, I would say that it's really about exploring and trying to find the truth of what's happening. And so that quest for truth, I think, tends to give it much more of a conservative kind of lean to it. And that's just kind of who I am. But I try to make it so it's not a show that pushes away anybody. You know, so it's, you know, maybe the topics people don't agree with, but, you know, we don't talk about the libtards or the vax zombies, or, you know, I cover the hard hitting topics, but in a way that, you know, I have people that email me or talk to me at a speaking event. And they say, gosh, Seth, you're the one show I can send to my liberal friends and family, because I really think that that's a big part of the mission. That's a big part of what I'm trying to do with the show, because I think that the divide in America, it's communist class warfare. And the more we're focused on the neighbor that we think is the enemy, the less we're realizing it's all part of a communist takeover. So as I mentioned before, I do about 5 interviews per week. I'm starting up a news show again soon. And I've got some other, you know, we're building out a new studio to do some longer form interviews, like more Joe Rogan style. That's also in the plans. But, you know, usually I do about 5 interviews a week. And I just try to find people that are willing to speak the truth about the important things that really matter. And that's the thing, is I really try to focus on what I believe matters. I'm not bringing someone on talking about the cocaine they found in the White House. To me, it's another great distraction, right? Or, you know, like, oh, Fauci roasted, you know, was roasted by Rand Paul. It's like, okay, what's going to come out of it? Right? I'm talking about the threat of an EMP. I'm talking about preparedness. I'm talking about, you know, the riots in France and how, what that means, you know, for America. Like recently I interviewed General Thomas McInerney, mm-hmm. you know, and it was a fantastic interview about what's happening in France and how he believes that's the blueprint, the game plan for America 2024. So, you know, in terms of guests, you know, some of my favorite guests, you know, Naomi Wolf talking about the jab, her husband, Brian O'Shea, who's mm-hmm. a special forces, special ops intelligence, fantastic guy to talk with. I've had Eric Trump on, and, you know, kind of fun conversation with him. Michael, you know, General Michael Flynn, a lot of doctors, Dr. Peter McCullough. He's been on a couple of times, Robert Malone. So it's really, I'm looking for the people that are trying to really, really bring out the truth, even if they're being persecuted for it or whatever. I'm trying to just explore that. And I try to approach things with an open mind. I have a lot of guests that come on that I don't necessarily agree with all of what they represent, but I think it's my job to bring these folks on, ask them good questions, and allow the audience to come to their own conclusions.
Seth, that's one of the things that I absolutely loved about your program, because honestly, I'm so used to listening to, and I can tend to be this way myself too, it's just a personality defect in me, is that I tend to listen to people that are very polarizing, that, you know, are going to take a strong stance. You still take that same stance, but you could tell somebody to go to hell and make them enjoy the trip. That's where you differ from everybody else out there, is that I could hear an interview that you've done with, let's say, Dr. Wolf, Naomi Wolf, who is, if you know anything about her, she basically comes from a leftist tradition, but she's at least a very honest, I don't even know if I'd call her a liberal anymore. I'd say liberty-minded. And she's always been very, I've always agreed with a lot of what she said, maybe not all of it, but I heard interviews with her in for years. I've been listening to her for years. And then I listened to the interview you did, and you tease things out of people that ordinarily they don't say, or you have a disarming way of getting it out of them. Even with General McInerney, heard him in many interviews. And there were things he said on your show that he doesn't say anywhere else, or I haven't heard him say anywhere else. And a number of other people, Dr. Kirk Elliott, you at least speak the language, and it shows, and it's intelligent, but it's not so highbrow that I can't get it, or a number of other people out there can't get it. But one of the things that I particularly enjoyed as of late, folks, let me just kind of set this up a little bit without revealing too much. Whenever I sat down at the table, I mean, William and I, we were there to visit Seth and his family, and we were sitting at dinner with he and his wife. And then I'm realizing, oh, snap, these two know as much about this stuff, these other things, as we do. And in many cases, they know a lot more. And these are things that we can't necessarily talk about on YouTube. Just extraordinary, astonishing conversation, comparing notes and learning things. It's just one of those things where you walk away from the table just wishing that you had 10 more hours to sit there and learn. At least that's certainly the way we felt. As of late, I know you do these fun interviews from time to time, and I was one of those fun interviews, hopefully. Wasn't too far out. But lately, I saw you do one with a guy that was flat earth. Now, I'm not critical. I applauded you. And here's why. I thought, okay, this is so far out of the wheelhouse of anything you typically do. This guy who was on there, I don't recall his name, but I'm like, okay, if I generally don't believe anything until it's officially denied. And I'm like, okay, he's making me think about things. I've heard this topic before. I'm not saying I agree with him or disagree with him, but the mark of any good thinker is the ability to hear any argument without necessarily agreeing or disagreeing. But I was floored when you had him on there, and I thought it was one of the most riveting interviews I've ever seen in my life. And this thing went on for 3 hours. I got to know, how did your other regulars feel about this? Because I was blown away by it. I enjoyed it.
It's really funny because, and that was a really out there interview, but I did it almost exclusively as an exercise. As an exercise of critical thinking. And that, and so, you know, when I, and it's funny because throughout the entire interview, I don't actually give my position very much. I say, well, that kind of makes sense, or that doesn't make sense. But I didn't come to the end of the interview and be like, gosh, you know what? Like, you've sold me the earth is flat. I walked out of the interview thinking, you know what? I think there's a lot that I don't know. And there's a lot that I thought that I know that doesn't make sense anymore. But I didn't come out of it, being some converted believer, just coming out of thinking there's a lot of stuff that just doesn't add up. And so it was funny because that was a topic that, you know, look, I've heard about flat earth for years, and always, as soon as I heard about it, I had this thing just click in my mind. That's retarded.
Me too.
That's stupid. Like, there's like, you're an idiot for even thinking that the earth is flat. But it's like, did I ever research it? It's almost like someone who's, if you say, hey, you know what, that jab thing, it might actually hurt you. And they're like, how dare you say that? You're an anti-vaxxer. It's like, whoa, where'd that come from? There's some heavy programming there. So I recognize that within my own self. And look, if there's one thing that I've learned, especially over the past, say, 5 years, it's that we've been in Plato's cave for generations. We have no idea how much has been hidden from us. Whether it's, you know, were there giants? Are there werewolves? Is there a Bigfoot? Are there aliens? Are there any of these things that it's like they could really craftily hide these things? What about Tartaria or Atlantis or, you know, prehistoric civilizations? All this stuff, right? There's so much that we just don't know. And if I look at a lot of things that I believe now, they're the same exact things that myself, say, 7, 8 years ago, mm-hmm. would not have even entertained. And so I'm trying to take that principle and apply it to my life, to me. I'm trying to look at my own beliefs about the world, about what I think is true and not true. And I'm really trying to question everything. And so I had heard an interview. I finally gave, because one of my good friends, David Whited, right, over at Flyover Conservatives, he interviewed this guy, Flat Earth Dave. And I had heard that interview because David said, look, you should listen to this. It's really interesting. And I said, you know what? Why not? I'll give it a try. I listened to the interview a couple hours long. And I was like, you know what? That's really interesting, because there's a lot of really intelligent people that I know that are in this movement or just outside of it that also believe the earth was flat. And so it's one thing if it's that one weird guy that's always sitting in the corner with dark dreadlocks and bags under his eyes. Like, hey man, the earth's flat. Okay. It's easy to write that off, but there's been really intelligent people I know that think that. And so I thought, you know what, just as an exercise, I'm going to bring this person on and I'm going to have a conversation and I'm going to approach this as someone that doesn't really believe in it. But I did my research ahead of time. I asked good questions. We had a really fantastic, fun interview. And the funny thing is that the reaction, there's three different reactions I saw in the audience, almost exclusively three different reactions. One reaction was the middle reaction, which was, wow, I hadn't thought about that very much. Thank you for doing the interview. There's a lot to think about. Okay. Then on the other side were people that were like, finally, you've now joined the Flat Earth Club and thank you so much. The other side though, were people that were saying, and I suspect that all the last side didn't even watch the interview, didn't even watch my introduction to it. They saw that I talked about it. And their response was that same thing as the person that said, you're an anti-vaxxer, get away, you're an anti-vaxxer. It was this response of, how dare you even kind of question this topic? How dare you even look at this topic? Like, you've lost all credibility. And it was like, well, like, wasn't the first journalist or the first investigator to question anything that was held to be common belief? Wasn't that person the person that was losing their credibility until they actually discovered that, actually, this is not how we thought it was? And everyone's like, oh, and so not that I was out to prove a point and try to prove some new theory. To me, it was just an exercise. And again, this is what, as I told you, you said, tell me about your show. And it's, the show is something where I'm genuinely trying to find the truth. And I'm asking hard questions. I'm exploring difficult topics. I'm trying really hard not to just reinforce my own biases and my own notions. And that's a hard thing. There's a lot of shows I listen to where you can tell that the show host has their ideas formed already.
Absolutely.
And they find guests. And it's easy to do. Trust me. They will only find guests that will then come on and reinforce what they believe. And so, that's just what the show is. But for me, I'm really trying not to do that. I'm trying to expand my mind in the interviews and go deep. And you mentioned one last thing before I'll kind of hand it back over to you, that interview with Naomi Wolf. And I've heard that feedback about a lot of the different interviews. They said, look, I've watched Ed Dowd interviews so many times. I've watched, Robert Malone or any of the people that, David Martin, like, I've watched so many of these interviews, but your interview was so different. And I think it's in a lot of ways, it's just who I am. And I think you know me in person, and how I am right now is exactly how I am sitting across from the table from you eating a burger, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm just a person that I try not to have a lot of ego. I'm not gonna say I don't have one, because I think that's a very arrogant statement to say I have no ego, but I'm just curious, and I'm not afraid to be wrong. I'm not afraid to be vulnerable. I'm not afraid to ask a question that might be a little bit offensive. I'm not afraid to ask somebody, well, how'd that make you feel? And ask them to look inside themselves and not just give me this intellectual answer of some study that they read about, but actually to dive into those things. And so that's where a lot of the interviews tend to go. It's like, actually, I interviewed Mickey Willis lately, mm-hmm. Recently, right? And that was an interview that, as I mentioned, in about 3 seconds, it went really deep. And it stayed there for almost the entire interview. It was this beautiful interview about divine purpose and the battle of good and evil and propaganda. And so anyway, so yeah, that's hopefully that's a helpful answer to
it. Is, you know, that's what I love about your show more than anything is that you're able to tease things out of people. You're able to tease things out of people that ordinary. I've seen numerous interviews with Naomi Wolf, Mickey Willis, even this Flat Earth Dave. But what that, the reason why I thought that was so incredibly awesome was, number one, it was way outside of anything I'd ever seen you do. But it made me ask critical questions in exactly the same way as it did for you, where I'm thinking, I'm walking away from this. First of all, I was riveted the entire, I think it was 3 hours you were with this guy. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense to me. But what I did at the end of the day, and what was critical, what was absolutely critical in my life, is that, you know what? I'm not so sure this guy proved that the earth was flat, but he did prove that the things that I assumed were right were wrong. He didn't prove it. He didn't prove a flat earth to me. And maybe I just need some more examination. I don't know. I haven't seen it with my own two eyes. But like you, I would have just, and in my own podcast, I would have dismissed this even 6 months ago. I wouldn't have even given it a second thought. And then because I heard you talking to this guy, I'm like, well, man, Seth isn't wanting to do a gotcha thing. Man, I got to listen to this. And then I was like, okay, do I want to? By the time it was all said and done, I should have sent you a text, because I was like, man, I can't believe how brave he was to get him on there. But I was thankful that you did. Did I believe everything he said? No, but he did make me ask critical questions about all the things I'm told. Now, speaking of which of those things that I've been told, I wanted to cover this because you kind of briefly brought it up earlier, and we just watched this movie ourselves. You cover a lot of things, and as of late, you know, some of your most recent videos had to do with a lot of the trans agenda. And of course, folks, I don't miss a whole lot of what Seth puts out there, because if he does, it's definitely worth checking out. Yesterday, folks, just to give you a background, I was going to talk about it on the podcast anyway. I don't want to give away too much of the story, but I'm not a guy that spends a whole lot of time crying, but I wept like a time I can't remember watching a movie Seth just brought up a little while ago. It's called Sound of Freedom. As everybody knows out there, we're in a fundraiser right now trying to raise money for Vets for Child Rescue. Basically, the people that kick in the doors to rescue these kids or work with law enforcement to get it done. This movie, in many ways, is about that sort of thing. They cover some of it. They don't cover the whole thing, but then again, it's a two-hour movie. How much can you cover? I saw this yesterday, basically took off a few hours to go watch this movie. I didn't want to watch it. And I was thinking, okay, well, it's in the big screen. How much could they possibly cover? It was enough to have me crying. Seth, I want to throw it over to you right now because you brought it up briefly about that movie, and I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts on it.
Well, it's like what I mentioned earlier in the show, that I think it's important for us to look at evil. Not that, you know, we should be watching, you know, snuff films of people getting beat up or murdered, or, you know, there's you can go too far with anything, but it's, we have to acknowledge and understand the depth of evil that we're up against in this world. Because I think there's a few things that happen when you see it. For one, you know how to protect yourself better from it. You know how to protect your children from it. When you realize, wow, the underbelly of this the criminal network is child sex trafficking, and when you understand the depth of that. And I've grateful. I've done some really good interviews with people like Lee Dundas, who used to go on missions over in Thailand and Cambodia, and she was telling me about some of the things that she experienced, because she was working with these special ops, you know, folks, and rescuing children from these child brothels over there. Even to interviewing Kathy O'Brien, someone that was sold into the CIA MK Ultra, mm-hmm, ritual abuse, you know, from her own father that was abusing her, right? And producing pornography of that. And so, you know, I've had these interactions, but I think that this is one of the subjects that, you know, we talked about, you know, fight, flight, or freeze. And when you want to talk to somebody about child sex trafficking, you'll usually get one of those three things. It's like, I don't even know where to place that. So I don't know. I'm frozen, right? Or it's like, I don't want to talk about it. They fly away from it. Or it's like, oh my gosh, I want to learn more. What can I do to stop it? And I think that that's what that movie does. That movie has taken it in a very brilliant way, in a way that's fit for the big screen in the theater. And while I agree, there's a lot I wish was in there. It's a 2-hour movie. It's not a, you know, a 10 episode series on Netflix where they can cover all the things I think that I would have loved to have seen on the big screen. But what they put into there was, I think, enough that for a lot of Americans, they're going to say, oh my gosh, like, I never thought this was happening. I've heard about child, you know, I've heard about, you know, human trafficking. But I think, again, this is, you know, I described earlier, living this kind of comfortable bubble of rural Ohio as I was younger. These things, you didn't bump into these things. It doesn't mean they didn't exist, though. And so I think that this movie, it's, you know, I encourage all your audience to go see it if they haven't, just, you know, so to support them and just, you know, just to also learn. But I think it's really important. And I feel like it's part of something that's happening in our society. I mean, you know, everyone's familiar with the Great Awakening, right? The whole idea that there's this mass awakening happening. And I think that it's like, what is that awakening? And I think that awakening is in a lot of ways, it's two steps. It starts with understanding the evil. It starts with awakening to the how much evil is in this world. But then I think the next step is also realizing how much good is in the world. And how much good we can bring to the world. Like, that's the second half of it. It's like you see the evil and it hits you. It's like what I went through, you know, back in 2008. I saw the evil, it hit me. If I didn't see that evil, I probably would have just gone on to some, you know, design career, and I would have had some golden handcuffs, and by now I'd probably be working out of Cincinnati in Ohio as a product designer for P&G, you know? And I'd be like, yeah, life is great, and, you know, I love the football teams and all that. But it was seeing that evil that made me say, you know what, I want to react to that with good, and I want to do good. So I think it's the fact that what I think is one of the darkest forms of evil, right, is the sale and the exploitation of children. I think it's going back even to biblical times for thousands of years. I think that has been, in my opinion, the number one most evil thing that people could possibly do. Is the destruction of these young, innocent lives and what they're doing. So when you bring an evil that dark and you put it on the big screen across America, it's going to change the fabric of our society, I think, in a very important way, in a very positive way.
Yeah, it just has, it can't be that Hotel Rwanda phenomenon where it was like they said in that movie Hotel Rwanda. Yeah, they were begging this reporter, get it out to the American people. And he's like, yeah, I'll get it out to them. But the problem is they'll watch it over the 5 o'clock news and they'll be like, oh man, that's so awful. Here, pass the potatoes. What's, you know what I mean? It's like, but the difference in this movie is that it's we are the number one, and I say we as the United States of Amnesia, we are the number one consumer of this evil. Whether and the movie does a really great job of giving you enough. It's enough to wet your beak. I mean, you don't know the full extent of what maybe somebody like yourself or what I might know, but you don't need to. What you need to do is go out there and see this movie, support the people that did it, get this information out there, make sure every politician has their door beaten down, and then your law enforcement, all of these other people, give to the people like you can, like Vets for Child Rescue, the fundraiser we're doing that's going to be up in Kentucky here before long at the end of October. You want to be there for that. And I'm wearing a t-shirt right now where it says, got wood chipper? And then on the back of it says, compost pedophiles. So if you want one of those shirts and you want to go to that event, don't worry, the link will be listed down below. But man, I really would like to leave it on a positive note, Seth, because that's really what you are absolutely brilliant at doing. You can take some very nasty, uncomfortable, information that I can't deliver, that I have no way of delivering, and somehow make everybody aware that they need to know this information, but also I don't know how you do it, but you leave it on a positive note just about every single show. It's some dreadful stuff, but somehow you're able to fill me with, you know what? I feel edified. I feel better after having listened to this, and I'm thankful that I did. So, Seth, where can everybody find you, and how can they reach out to you?
So, I'll answer that first quickly, and then I'll get into the kind of positive recap of how I frame everything. So, finding me, the easiest thing is go to Rumble or whatever podcast app you're using. Just search for Man in America. You'll find me. You know, I'm the only channel, social media similar. That's, you know, if folks want to contact, you know, just, there's our main website is maninamerica.com. There's a contact form on there, or the email is hello@maninamerica.com. But in terms of how to frame this, and this is how I've learned to look at what's happening, is that for a lot of people, I think, especially folks who are watching what you're doing and what I'm doing, you know, for a lot of them, I've asked them, you know, I've been out in these speaking tours or different events and said, when did you wake up to what's happening? And for a lot of them, it was 2016. It was 9/11. It was COVID. COVID is probably one of the most common answers. It's like, yeah, well, honestly, it wasn't until COVID or the 2020 election. And so what happens in that instance is you all of a sudden become aware of a depth of evil in this world that you were never aware of. And that can be really frightening. It can be very overwhelming to understand, oh my gosh, there's these bloodlines and there's this satanic ritual abuse. And the more you, and a part of your mind though, you want to dig into it. You want to say, well, like, what do they do? Like, what happens? Before you know it, you're reading Fritz Springmeier's book on the bloodlines and you're digging into, like, you know, John Coleman, and you know, you're really diving into this stuff, and you can have what they call the dark night of the soul, that moment where it all hits you, you curl up on a ball and you can't believe the amount of evil that exists. And you have to be careful because some people don't come out of that. And so what's really critical though, and how I like to look at this, is that it's not that our world has become necessarily more evil. I believe that what's happened is that there's always been evil. You know, like, look at, you know, Christ was nailed to a cross. So tell me there hasn't always been evil on this earth. So the key that I've come to with this is that the evil's been there. And actually the strength that the evil has had has always been in its ability to remain hidden. And so while right now it feels like there's evil everywhere, the evil is honestly, the evil is the weakest it's ever been, because they've lost their position. It's like you have a sniper that he's taken out dozens and dozens of your men. He's unstoppable. As soon as you figure out where that sniper is, you now know where to go. And you now know how to take down the enemy. And so that, as soon as you discover the enemy's location, that enemy becomes way weaker. And so right now, we've discovered the enemy's location. They're no longer hiding behind some bush taking pot shots at us. We have no idea what's happening. We see them now. And so that's something I have to remind myself, is that the fact that we see all this evil is an indicator that evil is weakening. It's losing its control. And like a rattlesnake that's backed into a corner, when it's losing its control, it's going to act the most frantic. But we can't allow ourselves to think that frantic evil behavior is a representation of power. It's actually a representation of weakness, because they can see that this great awakening is truly happening. There's a lot of people around the world that are standing up and saying, I am not going to participate in this evil system anymore. I'm going to go back to being human again. It's like you mentioned Joel Salatin, you're talking about, I'm going to go move out in the country. I'm going to grow my own food again. I'm going to, you know, bring my family back together again. So that's what's happening. And so the other part of it too is actually thinking, it's really easy, I think, for a lot of folks to look back and think, gosh, if I could just go back to 10 years ago, life was so good in 2013. It's like, oh, life was so good. There was no COVID. There was, you know, but looking at it, we had the same pharmaceutical companies. We had the same elections. We had the same government. We had the same corporations. We had all this stuff, the same education system, all that stuff was still there. So I don't want to go back to a life where all those evil institutions and evil structures still exist. I don't want to go back to that. I want to do whatever possible with my life right now to destroy those institutions and rebuild them, and rebuild them properly on just virtuous principles. And that makes me look towards the future. I think that for a lot of us, it's really easy to try to hang on to these memories of what life used to be like. But life will never be like that again. And you don't want life to be like that again. Now, maybe if you can go back to like the 1950s and you're riding your you know bicycle around the neighborhood, maybe that life I'd go back to. But the life I remember, I don't want it anymore. All I want to do is I want to work. I want to follow my purpose to build a future that is worth fighting for.
Folks, right there in a nutshell is exactly what I'm talking about. My man Seth, thank you so much for being on here, brother. Until next time, y'all, stay alert, stay alive.
Has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
Hello, it's Dan and Andy here from No Such Thing as a Fish, your favorite new podcast that you haven't heard yet.
That's right. We are a podcast that's been going 10 years, and each week we bring 4 of the best facts we've heard that week to the table to blow each other's minds, as well as yours.
Here's a fact, Dan. Did you know that the people of Iceland can use 95% of a cod?
Okay.
They're just working on that last 5%.
If you want to find out how they do that, why they do that, and why we're talking about that, check out No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts now.
I should say, despite my fact having cod in it, this is not a podcast about fish. It's about everything. I just happened to pick one of the worst and most confusing facts possible. Ta-ra!